listening to the Pharmacy Podcast Network.
Adverse drug reactions, or ADRs, are a serious issue in healthcare today. The pharmacist is the last line of defense to help prevent ADRs. A rising role of the pharmacist is the specialist who focuses on our children. Pediatric pharmacy ensures safe and effective drug use and optimal medication therapy outcomes in children up to 18 years of age. Currently, there are more than 1,450 board-certified pediatric pharmacy specialists, known as BPS. If you're interested in this expanding field of pharmacy, this podcast is for you. All right, everyone, let's give it up for our host.
Yay! Hi, good morning, everybody. This is Jenna Quinn from the Pharmacy Podcast Network. We're very excited for you to be here today and be listening to the Pediatrics in Review. I have my co-host, Justin Cole, who I'm super excited to be here, and our guest, Dr. Anna Esperum. I was like, off the cuff. So we're excited to talk about melatonin today in kids, because this is a medication slash dietary supplement that we see used largely in children and even more so in behavioral and medically complex children. So I'm super pumped to have her on. I'll let Justin introduce himself, and then we're going to dive into all things melatonin and Dr. Anna.
Jenna, yeah, it's great to be with you here on the podcast again. Before we dive in, I'd love to hear what's going on with Perfecting Peds. What are some of the new things that have been happening in the last month since we last recorded a podcast?
Yeah, so I'm super excited. We have our first, as you may or may not know, we were very provider and facility facing. Over the next month, we're launching two of our first managed care organization contracts across all lines of business, so Medicaid, commercial, and even employer, which is cool. Some employers are actually motivating families to partake in this medication therapy management for their medically complex children. So we're going to be partnered with thousands of families and caregivers, and most importantly, taking care of the patients that we love the most, that have really five or more medications that need the attention of a pediatric PharmD, but have never had that resource. And so we're excited to innovate, to push the envelope, and most importantly, to take the best care of these kiddos.
Yeah, keep it rolling, Jenna. I'm excited about where this is going. Well, let's go ahead and turn this over to Anna. Anna, we would love to just give you an opportunity to tell us a bit more about your background, and also maybe why are you interested in the use of melatonin in kids?
Yeah, so happy to be here. Thanks for having me. I am a pediatrician by training, and then I actually got really ill throughout medical school and residency. And so I went to become board certified in integrative medicine. And that's where nutrition was really the foundation. We had to study quite a bit about dietary supplements and the evidence for that, in addition to some other therapies, including mind-body, which I'm very involved in. And so I was really interested in chronic disease, just because I had that and my quality of life was pretty poor. And so I went and developed that extra kind of curriculum for myself to be able to help others with chronic conditions. And the interesting part about melatonin is that I also took care of a lot of children with neurodevelopmental disorders when I was in integrative medicine, because a lot of these kids who have autism or ADHD, they have trouble with certain nutritional deficiencies and insufficiencies, and helping them boost their nutrition with the dietitian that I worked with. And there was some evidence for melatonin, especially when they had difficulty with their sleep-wake cycle. So that's how I got into melatonin. But then I actually got into melatonin even a little bit more because I started becoming more interested and specialized in pediatric pain and headaches. And melatonin is something that we found that actually may help with certain pain conditions. And so we can get into that as we dive in a little further.
That's awesome. And I do, even as a pharmacist, and I'm sure Justin too, like there is something so true to nutritional deficiencies and just behavior in general. I know my anxiety spiked so bad. I've always struggled with anxiety, but once I realized my B12 was low and started supplementing that, I was like a new person. So I love integrative medicine. I think there's something that, you know, the two can be married for traditional medicine and integrative medicine.
And just a side note, that B12, I had this interesting case where someone had B12 deficiency and they were diagnosed with ADHD, learning disabilities, and they had severe B12 deficiency where they actually had to receive injections weekly. And after we finally got their B12 level, they started getting straight A's. They no longer needed their para at school. I was flabbergasted. So I thought that was an interesting case about B12. I had no idea.
Yeah, that it's made a world of difference. So I think there's something to both sides of medicine. Well, thank you again. We're super pumped to have you here. So just starting with the basics, what is melatonin and how does it help you sleep?
Yeah, so melatonin, everyone thinks it is a supplement. So it's actually a hormone that we produce naturally as humans. Actually, plants can produce it too. Animals produce it. But so it's a hormone. And so people have heard of vitamin D. It's like the new vitamin D, but vitamin D is also a hormone as well. And so we just have to be careful with hormones especially. Now, melatonin helps our sleep. So it helps in two different ways. So we most commonly know it as a hypnotic supplement, which means it helps put you to sleep. So that acts on a certain receptor that makes you fall asleep and maintain sleep. That's the M1 receptor, so melatonin 1 receptor. But the other one that a lot of people don't know about is that it helps our circadian rhythm. So, and that's the M2 receptor, the melatonin 2 receptor. So that affects kind of our day-night rhythm, our sleep-wake cycle. And it works differently. And so that's why we have to understand the two differences between the melatonin effects. So one maintains sleep, helps you fall asleep, and the one other one controls their circadian rhythm. So there's a hypnotic effect and a chronobiotic effect. So melatonin, when it starts becoming night, we don't have a lot of light, and which is troublesome now because we've got a lot of artificial light, we start producing melatonin in one of our glands in the brain, the pineal gland, that helps us get ready to fall asleep. But so artificially now we're staying up a lot later. We have a lot of screen time. Kids are on the iPads, on their computers, and staying up. And so that affects their melatonin release. There's other things that affect melatonin release as well, like caffeine, alcohol, certain medications. But the biggest one right now for kids is that blue light screen time. And so they can have difficulty falling asleep because their melatonin is not being released at night appropriately. So that's affecting their sleep-wake cycle.
Okay. Can you tell I have a guilty mom face as you're saying that? I'm like, oh, a pet blue light. I have no idea what you're talking about. My kids are never on the iPad.
I mean, nowadays it's just impossible to get your kids off of it because, I mean, they have to, this is what they use. No one's writing on paper anymore. We're not reading textbooks. Everything is on the iPad or the computer. It's just impossible.
Yeah.
So I think that's why we saw an increase in the melatonin intake and the melatonin use during the COVID-19 pandemic, because everything was online. Everyone's routine got thrown off. Everyone's circadian rhythm got thrown off. And so what do we seek? We seek a pill, right? It's the easiest route. We can just pop a pill and then help us fall asleep. So, but I think it's important that we're talking about this today because we have to use melatonin correctly. And it depends on what is going on in our bodies, because we can either use a small homeopathic dose to help reset our circadian rhythm, or if we truly have trouble with insomnia, then we have to use a larger dose of melatonin right before bed. So I'm going to talk about the two different ways to take it because this is super important to hone in on. So melatonin for those people who have trouble, say they can't fall asleep at a normal time, say they can't fall asleep at 9 or 10 p.m., they want to go to bed at 12 or 2 a.m. and then wake up between 10 a.m. and 1 p.m. in the morning. So that's kind of a delayed sleep phase disorder. And adolescents were hit the hardest because they don't have that melatonin release during this crazy neurodevelopment that they go through. And so a lot of these adolescents have a delayed sleep phase disorder where they can't release melatonin at the appropriate time. So that's why they fall asleep at midnight or 2 a.m. and don't want to wake up in the morning for school. So in order to reset their rhythm until they get through this neurodevelopment phase, they need to take a homeopathic dose of melatonin. So that's anywhere between 0.1 to 0.5 milligrams of melatonin, which is more often found in liquid form. It's hard to kind of get the small dose of melatonin, but you have to take this several hours before bedtime. So this can be usually like 3 to 4 hours before bedtime is when you need to take that. So it can say to your pineal gland, hey, we need to start releasing melatonin at the appropriate time. So that's the chronotropic, the chronobiotic effect of melatonin for the delayed sleep phase disorder for those whose circadian rhythm is thrown off. The sleep onset insomnia has a different dose. And this is typically, and it depends on what age group. So if you're talking school age up to adolescence, it's anywhere between 3 milligrams. And if you titrate it up slowly, it could be up to 10 milligrams. And this is 30 minutes before bedtime. And so that's for the sleep onset insomnia. And that's the hypnotic phase of the melatonin.
Anna, that is fantastic information. And it's what I found is that's difficult for me to communicate with the families that that I talk with. It's like, well, hold on a second. What you're saying that I need to take this earlier? Well, that doesn't make sense. Aren't they going to fall asleep at the wrong time? But the fact is that 3 to 5 milligram dose is way more than our own bodies can produce, right? This is, we're not talking about a physiologic dose. This is a super physiologic dose. And so that is, if you take nothing else from the podcast listeners today, that is gold right there related to melatonin. So Anna, thanks for sharing that. I'm also sitting here with my blue light blocking glasses on because I'm a cheater too, right? Unfortunately, instead of just shutting off my screens, I'm here with blue light blocking glasses to try to not have it affect my own melatonin at night. But yeah. Anyway,
that's what we have to do now. It's either the blue light blocking glasses or the programs that dim the light on the computer. So that's what I have to do too. I mean, it's a computer age. We can't get away from it.
Yeah, it's difficult.
And I am the worst sleeper, so I'm just sitting here like guilty of all that. But and I don't know, it was after kids that I just all of a sudden my body just stopped wanting to sleep. And it's annoying. And I'm just hyper at baseline. And so the two combined are just an awful cocktail for sleep.
Yeah, no, it is. And that's, my husband had the same issue as when he had his previous marriage, when he had kids, it's just, he couldn't sleep. It was like all of a sudden it was that hyper arousal and it was, that was it until the kid reached, you know, 18. So it's interesting.
Well, Anna, turning back to melatonin and kids specifically, you mentioned that during the COVID-19 pandemic, we saw usage spike a lot. So how common is melatonin use in children today?
Yeah, so it's pretty common. So the increase in melatonin, it's the second, I think, most used supplement in children today. And so very, very common. A lot of families are already on it by the time they see the pediatrician. But now there's not a ton of safety concerns that were available previously before this COVID-19 pandemic, but now we're starting to understand there are some safety concerns. There are some theoretical concerns still going on at the point where, because it's a hormone, there is concern that it can affect the hypothalamic pituitary axis. it's not yet proven, but we don't have long-term safety effects, okay? And so we just don't know. And so in some animal models, I think there has been some shifts in the development of puberty. So whether you can have earlier puberty or later puberty, depending upon the melatonin intake, but those animals were getting such like high doses, you know, super therapeutic doses during those studies. And so we just don't know in humans. The other thing is that there is significant drowsiness that can occur with the melatonin intake. And so there has been one case report that I know of out of the 260,000 poisoning reports involving the melatonin from the 2012 to 2021, I believe. One of those cases was a toddler, and there was intentional use. So a parent actually gave this toddler a ton of melatonin gummies in their sippy cup to make the child, right, fall asleep or be drowsy. The rest of, you know, who knows, understanding why this caregiver wanted to make their child fall asleep or be drowsy during the day. But the child was so drowsy, so depressed that they aspirated and died. So there is, there can be cases where you can take too much melatonin and not have enough arousal to overcome that. So we do have to be careful of melatonin, but the other safety risks that we think of are mostly that there is one, worries about increased seizure risk, which has been debunked. It actually has helped with the seizure risk because of the improvements in sleep. The other one is that withdrawal, everyone thinks that withdrawal can cause sleep disruption, but there hasn't been any withdrawal reports upon discontinuation of the melatonin. And then the third side effect that most people struggle with because it affects sleep is the nocturnal enuresis, so the nighttime urination. Mm. I don't understand the mechanism, maybe you guys do, but for some reason, melatonin can increase your nighttime urination, even for adults.
Interesting. No, I wasn't even aware that people were stating that it does cause that. And you think of, I think of the patients we take care of, some of them already have nocturnal enuresis. So I wonder if we're making it worse accidentally. So I think it's important here just to classify, you know, melatonin's over the counter. Why is this important? Because we think of FDA regulated medications versus over the counter. I think that obviously there's a place in therapy for over the counter medications, but I'd love for you to just articulate just the difference in regulations as far as the meds go.
Yeah, this is an important topic because there are so many different dietary supplement companies out there. Now, granted, a majority of them are owned by pharmaceutical companies and large corporations. However, these supplements are not regulated, so they don't have to have necessarily quality control, which means that they don't necessarily have to have the amount of melatonin that they say they do, or that there could be contaminants in the melatonin dietary supplement because they might not have a third party come in and take a look at certain batches to make sure they have the quality and purity. So they've done several studies, as you guys know, that they found that there's a varying amount of melatonin in several of these dietary supplements on the shelves. So it could range anywhere between 20% to 400% of the melatonin concentration. So it's a wide range depending upon what company. Now, there are some companies, though, out there that do the third-party testing, or it's the USP verified. So there's a couple different ways to make sure that there's quality and purity. However, you have to do a lot of searching and trying to figure out and calling the companies to make sure that they have a third-party company that tests those batches to make sure it's both quality and pure. One thing about melatonin is that the stability, because it's a hormone, we don't really know about it. So that could also mean that the concentrations are varying depending upon how long the shelf life is. The other thing is that how they make melatonin is it's synthetic. So they're synthesizing melatonin, because if you take it from an animal, it can have a lot of viral contamination, which is its own risk. But the other risk is that there are some metabolites that kind of contaminate the batch when you're making the melatonin, like serotonin, for example, can have there's some small amounts of serotonin, which is a common metabolite when you're making and synthesizing the melatonin. So the other thing is that there's a lot of other products in melatonin supplements that, even though it says it on the label, it might just have melatonin on the front and no one's looking at the ingredients in the back. And so you're looking at, you know, CBD and passion flower and a lot of other herbals that are mixed together. And so you just have to have someone who can help guide the family in how to take this, make sure there's no drug interactions, and make sure the child tolerates it, because there could be cross-reactivity, there could be drug interactions, there could be allergy responses, and based on the patient's history, we have to understand if this child can actually handle this dietary supplement.
And I was reading one of those recent reports looking at the actual composition of these melatonin products. One of them, even though it wasn't on the label, had zero melatonin and like a bunch of CBD. Literally, it contained none of what the label said. And so I think everyone needs to know this. These aren't even OTCs. They're supplements, which, like you've said, don't have any regulation. So we've got to be super careful to make sure we're using a product that really has what's on the label.
Yeah. It's a problem across a lot of dietary supplements. And so, you know, as integrative practitioners, really, we have to be the ones who go and research those companies. But the problem is that a lot of these smaller companies that are being bought by other companies then change their manufacturing process. So it is really hard to keep up with it.
Yeah, it is. So related to that, I wanted to ask about something that I've seen a trend in, and that is calls to poison control centers for melatonin. And we've seen emergency department visits go up as well in children. So with both these calls and visits because of melatonin use increasing, maybe talk a little bit more about those trends and a little bit more about the potential risks of using these melatonin supplements. Related to these overdoses, I'm curious, do you think we're actually seeing toxicity from the melatonin itself, or is it sometimes another component in the product that we just aren't aware of?
Yeah, so there is definitely an increase in the pediatric melatonin ingestions. And who knows if it's because also a lot of these dietary supplements and the melatonin supplements are gummies or chewables, or, you know, they taste like liquid candy. And so it is interesting how these need to be locked up in a cabinet so that the children don't access it because they think they're candy. So it increased by about 530%. I believe from that 2012 to 2021 was the last study that I read. So 530% increase in the number of ingestions. So that's pretty huge. There's been a lot of more serious outcomes from the melatonin ingestions, and that usually is they can have really severe depression, like not necessarily respiratory depression, but altered mental status. They can have severe drowsiness. It takes a while to come out of. And again, we don't know about the risk of the hormones, of their whole endocrine system, because there is a lot of feedback that goes on with melatonin, because it is almost like a grand controller for other different hormones throughout the whole body. So I think there's been two kids who've died, one of them that we just mentioned. Five children, I believe, required ICU care. So I think they did have that respiratory depression where they did require the mechanical ventilation. Now, we don't know, or at least from what the study has shown, if it was related to these different contaminants or metabolites that are in the melatonin, or if they had something else in the supplement. There are a lot of adulterants that these supplement companies put in so that they make their supplement more active. And so that's been well known in other studies outside of melatonin. So we do have to be careful.
Yeah, it's really scary because it's like you want, there definitely, like I said, is something and there's a place for natural supplements. It's just finding which one has the manufacturing process in place that's safe. So you know what you're taking. And, you know, approaching that with families for me is always like it's very, you have to do it cautiously because you want them educated, but you don't want to say like insulting them that they're taking it. That's not the case behind it.
Right. We just need to educate our families. And then I think for a lot of pharmacists or practitioners that are listening to this podcast today is taking a look at that. And I'll probably email this to you guys, is cool. The integrative medicine rubric that was developed by a lawyer, Mark Cohen, Eisenberg, and Kathy Kemper. And it's trying to help practitioners find the evidence and the safety for supplements and how to guide patients and families on the dietary supplement intake.
Oh, I love that. So I know we talked about it a little bit referring to adolescents, but what conditions and situations warrant melatonin use in the pediatric population?
Yeah, the biggest one is the one that we talked about for the adolescents when they have a shift in their neurodevelopment and can't release melatonin as well, and that's the delayed sleep phase disorder. Their sleep onset insomnia is very underrecognized and underclassified in pediatrics right now. And so it's actually being utilized for sleep onset insomnia, but it doesn't have a great evidence base. The other one has a lot more of the evidence base, which is definitely for the children with neurodevelopmental disorders, where they also have a disruption in the melatonin rhythm. So that's where we have to understand, we have to titrate and personalize the melatonin to each individual, and we really have to go slow with it. So even though I said for sleep onset insomnia, you can give melatonin 3 milligrams to 10 milligrams, you have to start off with the lowest dose because of the significant side effects like the altered mental status, the significant drowsiness, that depression that can occur with higher doses of melatonin. People can get, it's called the tachyphylaxis, so they can get used to the melatonin dose. And so then they have to kind of titrate, but very, very slowly upward so that they don't develop those significant side effects. Now I'm going to get in outside of sleep disorders because I'm a pain doctor. But so melatonin, now everyone thinks that melatonin can be used for all sleep disorders. And so that is wrong. The reason why is because melatonin has so many different mechanisms of action, which is great. So it's anti-inflammatory because it looks like indomethacin. So you guys know indomethacin, it is an anti-inflammatory. It stabilizes cell membranes. But one thing that it does is it inhibits dopamine release. Now, we need dopamine to have a healthy sleep-wake cycle. And so when we don't have enough dopamine, we can actually get periodic limb movement disorder. We can get restless leg syndrome. So when we're giving melatonin to someone that we don't know has restless leg syndrome, we actually can make it worse. So we have to be careful of what we have to diagnose the sleep disorder first before we give that melatonin. So that's why another reason this over-the-counter or the dietary supplement melatonin really needs to be guided by a healthcare practitioner that understands melatonin. Now, there are some other cool things about melatonin as well in that it also inhibits or antagonizes other inflammatory substances in the brain. So it antagonizes glutamate, which is a neuroexcitatory substance. And in our migraine population, since I'm also a pediatric headache doctor, it suppresses the CGRP release. So as a migraine, as a headache doctor, we actually give melatonin to abort the migraines and also prevent migraines. The studies are not... there are not any systematic reviews, but there's some good evidence that and anecdotal evidence that it's beneficial for a lot of kids who have severe migraines, especially chronic migraines, where medications have too much side effect. So I think it's interesting. The other fun aspect of melatonin is that there's been a more recent study. I think back in March of 2023, it was published. There was an association study, so it wasn't a randomized controlled trial, but that melatonin reduced self-harm among adolescents for those taking it to help with sleep. And self-harm disorders, as we know, mental health, we've got a big mental health disorder increase in our adolescents since the COVID-19 pandemic and even before the COVID-19 pandemic. And self-harm is really, really tough to treat. So I think this is going to be an interesting area to study for melatonin.
Anna, I'm curious, what kind of doses do you use specifically for migraine prevention and treatment?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the anti-inflammatory effects and inhibition of dopamine, so that's what we use. So like we use prochlorperazine to stop a migraine, so usually by IV. And so we have to give it 3 milligrams or above. Anything below 3 milligrams doesn't work for pain as the anti-inflammatory effect. So it does have to be 3 milligrams or above.
Okay. And obviously you give that at night.
We do, except for the abortive piece. So we'll do the preventive piece at 3 milligrams or above if we have to titrate 3 milligrams 30 minutes before bedtime. And then in order to abort a migraine, it's anywhere between 3 and 10 milligrams to abort a migraine if nothing else is working. So usually it's kind of more on the last line that we're using. So good question.
Yeah, and some of those headache medications are no joke. I mean, we have to use anti-epileptics or some of, you know, tricyclic antidepressants for these chronic headaches, and they're ugly drugs. Sometimes they're necessary, but they come with their own slew of ADRs. So are there any specific age groups for which melatonin is more appropriate and then which is less appropriate? I think, you know, as a mom going through with three young daughters, there's been times I haven't done it where, you know, my almost two-year-old hates to sleep, and I'm like, I just want to give her melatonin. But I mean, but yeah, so I would love your opinion and expertise on that.
Yeah. Okay. Great question. Because this is super important because, you know, babies have a very difficult time sleeping for some of them. Some of them, you know, it could be colic, it could be other reasons. Now, we do not want to give babies melatonin, especially 6 months or less, because that is when they are just starting to produce it. This is part of their neurodevelopment. They're getting the melatonin from the mother's breast milk. So it is absolutely melatonin. So that is definitely something to stay away from. Over anywhere between 6 months and 1 year is usually not recommended at all, because they typically, it's something else. It usually has nothing to do with the melatonin that they're having trouble sleeping. So it's very important to understand the root cause of the sleep issue versus giving them something that could make, you know, issues worse. So that is the main age group that is not recommended, is the very young infant age group. The other age groups, well, a toddler, typically, again, it's probably something else, unless it has to do with some neurodevelopmental disorder. That could be a reason, but typically not so. It's usually a little bit older. So that is where we have to be cautious and understand, or at least educate parents, caregivers, practitioners, how to help a baby sleep.
Yeah. I've always personally struggled with this as a mom. So I breastfed for 7 years, all the kids. I just finished up my 7 year tour. And, because of that, I always like freely got up at night and fed them whenever they were hungry. And it started, yeah, it was like the, whatever the book was, like the Ferber method, I was like the complete opposite, which was not great. So
That's every pediatrician. We're like recommending the sleep routine, and like the pediatricians do the exact opposite as well. I mean, we are not practicing what we preach.
So yeah, I like whenever sleep would come up or like anything, I would just fall real quiet, because I'm like, I'm not saying how awful I am with my children. So just quick aside, it's funny but not funny, my almost 2-year-old just doesn't sleep. So she had chronic ear infections. We got tubes. She was snoring. We got her adenoids out. The family joke is now she's out of surgeries that could make her sleep. So my family's you cannot do. Then she fell off. Like, she started falling off the growth curve a little bit. So in all seriousness, obviously, we did the workup. I have celiac, so we tested for celiac, thyroid, the whole thing. Nothing's wrong with her. So they just told me she's tiny and hyper, I guess similar to myself. But, you know, there's just, it is like so hard, though, when someone in your family has trouble sleeping. Like, I mean, I'm up almost every night from 2 to 4 a.m. And because I can't just let her hang out. I probably should. She just sings songs. Happy birthday. Happy birthday. Skidamaringa-dinka-ding. She's not sad about being awake, but just the caregiver tale to all that we're talking about.
The adversity that you have to go through as a parent of someone who does not sleep at all. Their temperament is totally different.
There's something to be said for developing empathy for your patients and the caregivers, right? When you go through it yourself, it's a powerful thing. Yeah. Anna, another thing I've seen melatonin used for, and this is pretty rare, when you have children born with congenital conditions that result in blindness, this can help like to moderate their sleep-wake cycle. And usually you don't need these massive doses. Usually you can get away with lower ones, which is one other interesting thing I've seen. I know we've been talking a lot about use in the outpatient setting. One of the things that I saw recently is that there are actually increasing reports of using melatonin in hospitalized children. So I'm curious if you could give us a little insight into what's driving these prescribing practices. Are we talking about an attempt to help with ICU-related issues? Is it something else? Or is it just continuing a medication that was prescribed, or not prescribed, but used by the family's outpatient? Do you have any insights there on this inpatient use?
Yeah, so the inpatient is hard because, you know, there are fluorescent lights, there's beeping, there's lots of activity, it's disrupting the sleep, and they need to sleep in order to heal. So that's when our main healing mechanisms, our immune system is activated, is during, you know, our deep sleep. And so I think this is probably the biggest indication, is trying to help regulate their sleep during an inpatient stay or during an ICU stay, because they're just, I mean, it's too much going on to actually have a healthy sleep-wake cycle. So that is the biggest reason that melatonin is being prescribed. And I, you know, we prescribed melatonin quite a bit for kids back when I worked on inpatient. But again, you know, I don't know, and I haven't seen this in the studies, whether or not that could be beneficial for the disruption in sleep. Does it actually help? Or could there be other ways that we can maybe change certain behaviors in the ICU, change ways that we take care of the children throughout the night in order to have them have a good, healthy sleep? So, so that I think needs to be studied a little bit more.
Yeah, and I know, like, as a pharmacist, you know, it's like the lesser of evils, because you know, they just, a lot of them have been on sedation for and analgesics, so those long drips for, you know, 5 to 7 days, and you don't want to do anything that's going to make it worse. And like before you could even intervene, sometimes you come in, they'd be on a benzo at night to sleep, or we're starting an antipsychotic, obviously, which has its place in ICU delirium, or diphenhydramine. But like you don't want, you know, for me, I'd rather try something like melatonin before going to and grabbing those types of medication. So I would love for us to do a study as it's like use in ICU delirium would be a really cool study, because I think there's something there.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. Yeah, the lesser evil, that is an important concept.
Jenna, that's a great segue into one of the other questions we wanted to ask Anna, and that is, what future research do you feel like we need to pursue to clarify the role of melatonin in children? What would be the studies you would design if you had unlimited resources?
Yeah, I would do the long-term safety effects of melatonin. I really am interested in how it can affect a child's hormones, endocrine system, because it's such a black box. And looking at the mechanisms of melatonin, it makes sense that it could affect our hormones, the child's hormones, especially with the development that's going on. So I would be very interested in the long-term safety effects and looking at all the different kinds of hormones and seeing what melatonin does to what. And so I think that would be very interesting to me. The other thing about melatonin that I would like to be more studied is, again, looking at randomized controlled trials of the melatonin supplementation for certain conditions and what dose is recommended.
Yeah, I think that would be awesome. I think in a lot of ways, long-term literature for a lot of meds are lacking. For many families, obviously, as we kind of articulated, think this is safe and natural approach to help their kids sleep. But how should, as a healthcare provider, how should we educate these families regarding those types of claims?
Yeah, so natural is often claimed in many supplements and many different therapies and even foods. And so just to explain, you know, one case, and this is an N of one with me, is that I was eating all natural and trying to go all whole foods and all organic. But, you know, to save time as a pediatrician, you know, working, you know, so many hours, I was eating, what was it, canned soup or box soup or something, and it had natural flavors at the very end of it. So natural flavors. And so I was saying, okay, well, natural, right? So it must be natural. Well, really, it's all chemicals. All those naturals, what is natural? You can say anything is natural. I mean, if it exists, it's natural. So I was having migraines every single time I'd eat the soup because I think it had MSG or something in it. So I was like, oh man, yeah, this is not natural. So we have to be careful with the word natural because it does not mean that it's healthy or safe. I think it's a marketing scheme, I would say. I think it's trying to promote, oh yeah, it's good for you, but that's not really what it means.
So keeping on that practical line as we come toward the end of the podcast here, what other practical tips can you share regarding proper melatonin administration, especially when we're using those smaller doses, as you mentioned before, like using liquid, et cetera? And are there particular dosage forms that you might avoid because of the concern that kids might think they're candy, something like that? So what are some of those practical administration tips you would have for parents?
Yeah, so the key for parents, the number one thing I always talk to them about is that a lot of these supplements are also symptomatic. So I know a lot of people go towards supplements because they want to avoid a pharmaceutical, but it really is very similar in terms of just symptomatic care. So instead of going towards the root cause other than nutritional deficiencies, we're really just providing a pill. It's like a quick fix. It's something to give you until what we work on, like sleep routine, sleep hygiene, trying to get to the root cause until that kicks in. And then maybe we can go off the melatonin. So not something that we're going to rely on forever. We need to just do that to help bridge the gap until this child or person starts feeling better while we're working on the root cause. And so that's kind of where the hard work comes in. Now, the liquid, I do like the liquid supplements only because you can do lower doses of the melatonin. So the chewable tablets and the gummies, the problem with those is that there seems to be a little bit more data in that there's not as much, it could have less melatonin, it could have more melatonin. And so I don't know about the manufacturing practice of the gummies or the chewable tablets, why it makes it to have different quality and identity in it. And it could also be with the liquid, because they might have to shake it up so that the melatonin is in the same amount where they're drawing it up with the dropper. So you got to shake it up. You do have to have that right amount. So if it's going to be 0.1 to 0.5 milligrams, it's going to be a very, very tiny dose, and you can overdo that or overshoot that with the family. So it's kind of nice to have that supplement there with you if you can, or go through it, go have them buy the supplement company that you know has good manufacturing practices, understand the dosage form, and make sure they know how to give it to the child. I think that's the best way.
Yeah. And I think, just like you're saying, when we do these comprehensive managements with the family, like, I always ask, can you show me the bottle? Because there's so many different concentrations of the liquids too. So someone can think they're given, you know, X amount of milligrams, and really they're just giving a little bit of the dose. After listening to this and learning from you, that might not be a bad thing, but we all want to be on the same page with what they're giving. That recently happened to me a couple weeks ago, where it was actually like untraditionally dilute. So she was just giving like a peanut of a dose. And so again, I think the variation in concentrations, just like you said, as a healthcare provider, if we have that actual source and bottle available, that's the best thing. To that vein, is there any specific brands that you like are your go-to? I know for some, like, for example, I know Nature Made is one that I've recommended for my patients. Is there any brand that's like your go-to for melatonin?
Yeah, so Nature Made is probably the best one right now, just because of the USP verification. But now, not necessarily for liquid melatonin, but for capsules melatonin for adults or for adolescents, the two companies that I know that still have good manufacturing practices that haven't been bought yet are Designs for Health and then Zymogen, Zymogen. So those are the two companies that have not been bought yet. Everyone else has been bought. So I have to like redo all understanding of the manufacturing practices for all the other supplement companies. It used to be Pure Encapsulations, but they were just bought. So I have to go back and check and see how they're doing it now.
And Anna, one thing I'd like to stress that you just mentioned briefly is the fact that we tend to live in a culture that wants the quick fix, right? When someone's struggling with sleep, in particular our children, we want to just give them something immediately that will work. But the reality is we need to do the hard work of A, looking for the underlying causes, working on sleep hygiene, trying to make sure that we are doing everything else to get to the root and help them to have good practices. Number two, we need to look and see if are there other medications that may be contributing to this insomnia. And then only after that, number three, should we think about using medication therapy, whether that is a supplement like melatonin or any one of the other agents that's sometimes used in kids, which is a whole other podcast episode, right? But we need to be looking at this in kind of a stepwise approach and making sure that we are looking holistically at the health of the child and not just trying to symptomatically make them sleep better. Now, we know sleep is going to help improve their growth and their neurodevelopment and all these other things, but we need to be doing the hard work, as you've encouraged us to do, related to helping out these kids when they have sleep onset insomnia and other conditions. So thanks for those reminders. It's great.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, and now I have major mom guilt for my iPad use at 7 and 8 o'clock at night. So follow up with me next week. My kids are going to hate you, Anna. I don't know.
I'll be the bad guy. Yeah, like, because the parents are always like, Dr. Anna, tell my kid not to use their phone at night. And I'm just like, well, is that my job?
It sure is. Because as a mom, I'm always like, they'll listen to you better. Like, just say it, Dr. Anna. So thank you so much. It was a true pleasure. I would honestly love to have you back on. I think we could talk to you for hours. Pain, headache. I mean, this is all such good stuff. And this podcast in particular, I feel after talking to you for an hour, even better equipped to educate my families. Because like I said, it's something that comes up so much and the research and the literature isn't there. And so just your deep dive and how the medication works, the various ways that you can use it has been huge. So thank you so much, Dr. Anna. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, guys.
That's all for today's episode. Thanks for listening. And remember to subscribe on Apple Podcasts and leave us a review.